Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
All right. November 27th, 2021, Thanksgiving weekend, Indigenous Peoples Day. We are live. Call in if you need to, push 1 if you want to talk. And I got my host Mike over there at the boards. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And
hello.
Hey, so Kevin Strickland was out of jail after 50 years of a false charges, and you know MIT says about 25% of all people convicted of murder are innocent. And
I didn't know it was that high, but yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah,
I mean we've had witnesses say that if there's a murder and you're standing a block away, the first person the KCPD picks up is charged with the homicide. And, of course,
that's sick.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, a defense attorney in Kansas City is $10,000 cash up front to even look at your case. And, you know, the public defenders, I'm not being sympathetic, but They're overwhelmed, and they probably maybe have an hour to work on your case. And, of course, they just tell you to plea bargain. And so these people in Kansas City, they don't have a choice. I mean, they go to trial, then, you know, they got, you know, like a Rittenhour situation where you got 11 white jurors and one black juror. You know, it's stacked against you, you know, and the food pantry's demand is up 40% in Kansas City, and their volunteers are down about 300% because of COVID. And so the captain of industries are finding the coins in their couch to toss out a few parcels of food items so people can keep those 200 calories a day they need to function. And so yeah, we're going into a dim reality of normally known as the holiday season, but yeah, the Omicron variant of COVID has made it to the UK. There were 60 people on a plane coming out of South Africa to Israel that were positive, tested positive. And so South Africa already has a quick testing program set up. And so that's kind of that's kind of the news in short. You know, some of my contacts at KC Homeless Union had to go in for some antibiotics yesterday, and with a sinus infection, and that was, you know, it looked like he'd been stung by a hive of bees, and so yeah, so I mean, you know. There's a lot of myths that are about the American experience are crumbling around us, you know, that I think I was reading, you know, there really never was a golden age as the mythology tends to get people to believe, you know. I mean, there really wasn't a goddess Columbia on the Santa Fe Trail, you know, guiding the way, you know. It was the, you know, it was the John Chisholm's, and it was the, you know, so yeah, we're back on the Santa Fe Trail, basically. And, you know, it's hard tack and bacon rind from here on out.
I could go down What? Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I was just adjusting my headphones.
Okay. I was reading the Kansas City Star, and they said that according to Missouri law so far, that prisoners wrongfully incarcerated receive no help, compensation for being wrongfully convicted. And to make matters worse, well, better, the Kansas City Star has resorted to the local newspapers, out-of-state listeners. So the daily newspaper Kansas City Star report that was providing lists of charitable groups for the people that are getting out of prison wrongfully committed, serving years in prison, where they could go, or where the reading public of the can send donations. That's a pretty slavish type thing, man. Considering the law is written so that the state's not responsible for proving people absolutely that they're guilty of a crime before they incarcerate them. You know, I mean, that's pretty sick. Then I just heard this on the news, and I don't have the source, but then they say someone started a GoFundMe page for Kevin Strickland, the most famous of the ones that have been held for, I believe, for 43 years. And they allegedly raised $1 million. So you get these conflicting answers, you know, from the Kansas City Star. And then I should have wrote down who sent that out about his GoFundMe page. But it always ends up dumping it on the people. Seems like, you know, whether you're, you know, it's a mess. And Kansas, over here in Kansas, we had a guy right here in my home county. He did 14 years for a murder his brother committed, and DNA proved it had been wrong, and he got out. Now, he did get – the state government did pay him something. I think there's a – but there was no law to do that until he got out and became widely publicized about his wrongful conviction. And he ended up – I think there's a cap. The idiots in the state house in Topeka – wrote a law, I think it's $250,000, but he did 14 years. That's a small, I guess that would get you started. And he lost his family farm, property, acreage, and I think that's pretty sick. Our society can convict people, find out that they're wrong later, and then just kick them back out on the curb. You know, I guess that's not surprising to you, huh, Carl?
Well, no, and you know, that was the Innocence Project that put out the GoFundMe, and their goal was to reach $7,500, it just took off. So when I first read it, like 48 hours later, they were already up to 600,000, and yeah, they hit seven, and then Kevin Strickland got to turn the lights on at the plaza, which is like millions of bulbs, Christmas bulbs. And there was a Kansas City Chiefs player that was going to do it. And so Kevin, you know, to walk out of jail and 48 hours later be turning up, flipping the switch for the lights, you know, that probably as a kid you dare not even go into the Country Club Plaza, because, you know, we had a situation. The last mayor had started a 9 o'clock curfew, so teenagers couldn't go into the plaza area, and so that was a bit of a fiasco, and that actually started shining a little bit of light on Kansas City, what's going on here. And so there's, you know, there'd been several times, a lot of times during the holiday season, where Kansas City was making the New York Daily News Sunday column and Sunday page. And, you know, what comes to mind was when KCPD was pouring bleach on food that was being donated down there in Pershing Park. The free hot soup folks would go down there and serve several times a week. And there was some really tragic, starving people, you know, trying to find food that didn't have bleach dumped on them. And that made, so that would have been the last mayor. And, so, you know, just right down the line, all the apologists that, you know, okay, it was their time to step up, you know. And, you know. Oh yeah, and people take note of some of these things, you know, and after the decades go by, it's like, you know, they've not been on the right side of compassion, just time after time, yet they're, you know, religious figures and you know, captains of industry and these types. And it appears that, you know, Kansas City is somewhat getting disgruntled with a lot of the the cold comfort that's offered out here, probably the richest city in the Midwest, if you look at all the agribusiness that's here. And of course, I kept telling myself, like, I'm not going to be sarcastic, you know, it's the holiday season, let's lighten it up. But yeah, the prisoners are suffering, and Kevin Strickland, he was released from up there in Cameron, Missouri. And that's the one we talk about, where the land for the prison was donated, the individual owned, you know, built a strip mall at the gates. So visitors,
and you didn't make this shit up, Carl. You're not making this shit up, are you?
I know, but it's hard for me to even mention it without sounding sarcastic, because, you know, when it becomes rapid fire, like it's a Jackie Mason routine, you know,
right.
Or Alan King, you know.
Well, the issue is it's true. The land was donated, and the guy built a strip mall in front of the place. Is that right?
No, that's right.
That's sick.
And, it's just all this law enforcement and this mass incarceration, it's just to prop up the captains of industry and the big property owners. And somehow, you know, they make it appear like we're somehow benefiting from this.
Yeah, they're such wonderful people down there at the Crown Plaza. Out-of-state listeners won't understand the irony there. So let's sort of clear it up. I mean, you could go into the history. You're good at that, of this local landmarks, as they call them. But I could tell you, not everybody's rich there, but I've been up there. It's like a tourist attraction. You go there, and it's all the products are so expensive, you're afraid to buy anything when you go there. I'm talking as an out-of-towner, and I haven't been there in years and years, because it's just like, what's the point? And it's largely a lot of very wealthy people congregate and own businesses there. Would you say it's not? I mean, it's not like Wall Street or anything, but it's
It has a garden variety of vanity boutiques. You know that don't you know
yeah.
people
yeah.
with enough money don't necessarily have to put a lot of effort other than keeping the doors open. But yeah,
right,
that's what
right.
I've noticed, like Rodeo Drive being the model, and then we've lost some of those, legacy stores like Jack Henry's. Like, where does a person get a spring wardrobe now? Where are you going to find a tailor?
Yeah.
You'd think you would go to Jack Henry. But so that these things make wealthy people uncomfortable. And of course, the luxury condominiums are just being bought up by people from out of country, and just socking away money, hand over fist. And that's why the demand, for these one light two, and I think they're on like the third tower now that they're building, and then they're offering like 800 square feet apartments for the janitors and things and working class people just assume not look at them as they look at us,
Carl, somebody gave a buttload of money to Kevin Strickland. And now he's turned the lights on at the Country Club Plaza, listeners. And I think this is to make them show thanks. It is supposed to be the Pilgrims parade today. We're showing thanks, and now we can forget about it, right? I think that's what's going on.
Biden.
Go ahead.
Just like Biden said, the system is working. The system is working, as Biden said. Rittenhouse was judged by a court of his peers.
Oh God.
I mean, Strickland. I've had to set back about this, because a lot of people are like, "What in the hell is he? Why would they do that to him?" I mean, just the description of his first night free, hearing the creaks in the house and the humming of the electrical lines, and just the loss of control of his surroundings, of that PTSD. I feel every prisoner should get a stipend, because their life is wrecked. Their health is wrecked, and how do when you're not even used to opening a door on your own,
people don't think like that. I mean, I agree, and that's the real experience of my two brothers, one now deceased, who have been in and out of the prison systems in Kansas. You're right, and most people don't understand that stuff. And the only reason I did is because I had some immediate family members go in and out over their lives. So, I mean, but people don't get that. And I think do we owe the Kansas City Star anything? I don't think we do, but in one thing, I think this is perfect timing. I wonder if for him to be released. Now there's a bunch of others that need to be released also in Missouri. But I'm wondering, if it's not some dark conspiracy. It's just that maybe everybody that reads the Star feels guilty. I don't know, man. I don't know. But it was something unusual. I read that this morning, and I thought, huh. I didn't hear about the country lighting up the Country Club Plaza lights. That's a big, big deal among the petit bourgeois in this area. I know. Watching the lights come on. everybody brings their kids from all over the area. They go there to see and awe the lights coming on the plaza. But anyhow, you have a news clip? Has it went stale or should we play it? What's it up to you?
No, I think we should. I think we should play it, and then maybe we follow up a little bit more on it, because it's really what's been going on since the last show in Kansas City. There was the killer of Cameron Lamb is on here, and go ahead and run it.
All right, let's run it.
This one's from Jason Kurtz, KMBC Channel 9, Carl G. Reading. KC tenants hold town hall meeting to discuss the housing problem in Kansas City. Kansas City housing crisis took center stage Thursday night. It was the focus of House the People Town Hall hosted by KC tenants. The tenant union wants safe and affordable housing for everyone in Kansas City. About 100 people attended the town hall meeting discussing what more can be done to fix the housing problem. KC tenants laid out many solutions they see to fix the problem, including social housing, which leaders described as a permanent and accessible housing controlled by the community. Mayor Quentin Lucas attended the town hall. He said he's willing to work to see social housing in Kansas City, but says it would take change in Missouri law and work with state officials. Right now, it feels the city is more focused on the people they want to be here and not the people already here and have been here for generations, says Brian Holby, a community organizer for KC Tenants. But both the mayor and KC Tenants hope to work together. I appreciate that this group stays active. I disagree with a lot of the tactics sometimes, but I don't disagree with the outcome we seek. And we need to get people in a safe and affordable housing in the long term, says Mayor Quentin Lucas. This is from KCUR Kansas City, NPR, by Carlos Moreno, November 24, 2021. Kansas City food banks are keeping up with 40% increase in demand but need more volunteers. Food pantries in the metro are seeing more clients than ever, but generous donations are helping them meet the demand. They also say it would keep at least 2 years before families get back to where they were before the pandemic began. The high cost of food nationally has kept Kansas City area food banks busy this holiday season. Typically, we would have families use this pantry about 3 times per month, said Mary Esselman, the CEO of Operation Breakthrough. We are seeing families that are maybe using it even more than 4 times a month, some several times a week. Esselman said the driving factors are high prices for staples and fuel. It's harder to stretch your dollar right now with items such as gas and dairy and meat a little bit higher. Denise Ogilvie, chief mission of the Catholic Charities in Northeast Kansas City, said her organization has also seen higher numbers of people seeking food compared to last year. One of the things we have started to see is an increase in people coming through the door, also an increase in the first-time pantry goers, new people to our pantries, Ogilvie said. Ogilvie said donations of money and food have been consistent throughout the year. If anything, she said that what they need is more volunteers. We went to having 1,800 volunteers a month to 300 volunteers a month when the pandemic hit, and it's been very slow to grow back. Ogilvie and others at food pantries across the metro stress that the factors drawing more individuals and families to their services won't end when the holidays are over. Brittany Patton, who is also rolling out a Hope Distribution Center on Wednesday, said with her cart stuffed full of pantry items that she's been out of work to an injury, so her husband is the sole provider right now. Meat prices have risen, and they help out with a couple of things that for me and him wouldn't last a couple weeks, she said, and they help out with the other food groups like bread and stuff. She said Thanksgiving would be difficult without the support of the food pantry. It helps because of our family on both sides. Harvester Community Network, the regional food bank that supplies most of the metro's food pantries, has not had a serious supply chain problem, she said, communications manager Gene Hallman. She said they've been able to keep up with the need, but she knows pantries are facing a high demand. The past year has been really hectic. They've all seen 40% increases across the board and people asking for help, Hallman said. She said the agencies are well-versed in predicting their needs, and many pantries have returned to client choice shopping instead of prepackaged kits that they're offering last year during the pandemic. This means the clients are allowed to shop in person inside the pantries, which also helped to move food more efficiently to clients. Harvesters has run fairly smoothly this season. They've had fewer volunteers who have been able to cover those gaps with their own staffers. Harvester also has been receiving generous donations and supplies from different sources. However, Hallman said the public shouldn't stop donating or relax its giving mood. Hallman cited a report from Feeding America that estimates it will be at least 2 more years before families get back to where they were before the pandemic began. Yahoo News. Missouri detective found guilty in 2019 fatal shooting of Cameron Lamb, by Chauncey Alcorn, November 20th, 2021. Detective Eric J. DeValcare becomes first Kansas City cop to be convicted for fatally shooting a black man. The white Kansas City police detective who fatally shot Cameron Lamb, a black man, in December 2019 in Kansas City, Missouri, was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and armed criminal action on Friday. Circuit Court Judge J. Dale Young convicted Detective Eric J. DeValcare of both offenses Friday after a 4-day bench trial that ended last week, according to KCUR. DeValcare previously waived his rights to a jury trial. He is believed to be the first officer in 70 years to have stood trial for a shooting and killing of a black man, according to local NPR affiliate. I'm happy that the judge saw fit. He followed the law, but I miss my baby, and this did just not have to be, Lamb's mother, Laurie Bay, told reporters on Friday. Duvalcarre remains free on bond pending his sentencing, which Young's declined to schedule on Friday. Multiple news sites reported the defendant could face up to 4 years in prison at sentencing, according to ABC News. Duvalcarre's conviction came nearly 2 years after prosecutors said he shot and killed Lamb while the 26-year-old mechanic and father of three was sitting in a red pickup truck and backing it into the basement garage in his backyard on December 3rd, 2019, according to the Kansas City Star. During his trial, Duvalcarre told court he and fellow detective Troy Schwinn responded to the scene at Lamb's residence after a third detective informed them of a nearby high-speed chase involved in a red pickup truck and purple Mustang. Police helicopter identified the truck to Lamb's residence near intersection of 41st Street and College Avenue. Duvalcarre and his attorney said he and Swam, both in plain clothes, converged on the resident with their guns drawn as they headed to the back of the house where Lamb was parking the truck he was driving. Duvalcarre testified during a trial that he shot Lamb after seeing him wielding a gun. Prosecutors testified during the trial. Prosecutors suggested Lamb's gun was removed from his home and planted on him, along with multiple bullets, after he was shot, according to KCUR and Kansas City Star. Duvalcarre's defense team argued that he was responding to a potentially dangerous situation that had been caused to enter Lamb's property. Duvalcarre's defense team argued that he was responding to a potentially dangerous situation and had probable cause to enter Lamb's property. Prosecutors contended Duvalcarre acted recklessly by shooting Lamb within seconds of encountering him. Young sided with the prosecution while determining the backyard area Duvalcarre and Schwamm entered within curtilage, meaning they are part of Lamb's home and therefore the occupants who live there demonstrated a reasonable expectation of privacy. Lamb family attorney Lee Merritt called the verdict monstrous and historic outside the courthouse on Friday. These instances of judges in our system are far too rare, but there is something that happened here that was different, Merritt said, according to KCUR. This was Channel 41 KHHB, Kansas City. Unsigned memo, KCPD Chief Rick Smith to retire in April, receives compensation through August. This is by Addy Weekly, November 24, 2021. An unsigned memo on behalf of Kansas City, Missouri Board of Police Commissioner outlined the details of Chief Smith stepping down in 2022. Tolbert, the memo said his purpose was to confirm that an agreement for the phased retirement of Smith. The memo determined Smith will drop down as Chief Police and publicly announce retirement on March 1st. His last day on the job will be April 22nd. KC Mike Mahoney tweets, ally of KCPD Chief Rick Smith, Councilmember Teresa Loar, says she has talked to Smith in the last hour about reports he is out as Chief. I just talked to the Chief. He isn't going anywhere. She tweets to KMBC. This is from Fox 4 News, Kansas City. Community groups weigh in after KCPD chief announces plan to retire. Tia Johnson, November 24, 2021. One day after Kansas City Police Chief Rick Smith confirmed plans to retire sometime in 2022, the focus began shifting on future leadership. Community groups and individuals are starting to weigh in on what type of leadership they'd like to see. I hope they're not biased when it comes to people's genders, people's races, people's ethnicity, said Whitney Lawson, Kansas City resident. We demand to be at the table of the selection process begins, says Pastor Darren Edwards, co-founder of Getting to the Heart of the Matter. We want to be at the table. We're not just listing these offers and offering these as a sheet of paper. Edwards has recently met with other community activists and current police officers to come up with some requirements for the next chief. These include must have a background in dealing with diversity in communities, guardian mentality with all communities, open door policy to the community and leaders, and willing to listen to and respect all voices. Offers bottom-up, out-of-the-box solutions and strategies within the department handling community issues. Believes in financial transparency of the police department, believes in holding bad character in the department accountable. The next chief must come out of the state, including Kansas. Every resume from with the current department needs to be rejected. The next chief have a documented history of building community engagement partnerships and community involvement accountability boards.
Portland is a town that's in the news much of the time. There are a lot of vegans and there's very little crime. It's a nice, safe place to live. Folks ride bicycles a lot. The winters aren't so cold and the summers aren't so hot. They build houses out of cob. They hang out in the park where you needn't worry about walking after dark. There are lots of homeless people, but they don't hurt no one. Just be careful of the boys in blue playing with their guns. Yeah, watch out for the cops. 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 You can hang out with the punks, with the piercings and tattoos. You can can eat out at a food truck, any neighborhood you choose. You can dance to Balkan music while you drink a microbrew, chilling in a gay bar with the mayor and his crew. But be careful what you do, be prepared to get some flack, especially for those who may be male, young, and black. The fact is you do better in Sweet Home Alabama. You're safer there on the old streets of Birmingham. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Prisons with some nice electric chairs. You can go downtown, ride the buses there for free, but you never know when you'll get a DWP. A town full of progressives, but such a rotten bunch of cops. Who knows who'll get shot at the next routine traffic stop? When you live in a place like Portland, where they tend to act this way, you can just join the police force instead of the KKK. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops.
That's Dave Rovics, Watch Out for the Cops. Of course, Dave Rovics is from Portland, and he's been on Radio Free Kansas. You can be listening for Carl G, our host tonight. We'll be right back in just a minute. Here's Pete Seeger. Hold. It's called What a Friend. It's a rarely heard Pete Seeger song, and we'll see if we can rustle up Carl G. Come back on the mic.
Well, Ernie is a man of very definite opinions himself. And last year he wrote me a letter. He said, Pete, he says, I don't think people get in enough arguments in America today. See if you can't stir up some controversy with this. So we'll try. What a friend we have in Congress, who will guard our every shore, spends three quarters of our taxes getting ready for a war. Guns must make our coastline bristle, and we have to fill the sky full of planes and guided missiles. They'll be paid for by and by. Have you noticed all the progress in our mighty airborne fleet? By the time a plane's adopted, it's already obsolete. There's no factory profit, brother, and we have to do or die. One improvement, then another, they'll be paid for by and by. Modern bombs are sure to carry loads of glory, joy, and thrills. What a privilege to bury all the dead our money kills. Never mind the widow's weeping, disregard the orphan's cry. When God wakes the dead and sleeping, they'll be paid for by and by.
All right, so good old Pete Seeger there.
Yeah.
An oldie but a goodie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rare. Hard to find that one.
Yeah, it's amazing. The guy was a massive pop star in the 60s. I don't know if people realize that. Had the Birds doing his songs it was a pretty amazing career.
Yeah, he sang with a group called the Weavers for a while, and then McCarthyism kicked in. This is what my reading of it, and they got scared of him because he was a commie, whatever. He never really defined himself. But he got called up between the House Un-American Activities Committee. Became hot. People didn't. It was sort of weird about Pete Seeger. He never really went away, but he was certainly. He was certainly stigmatized in the society in the late 50s and 60s, wasn't he? Yeah, I don't know. Strange guy. Strange guy.
Yeah. Interesting life. Yeah, yeah. Knew Woody Guthrie in the prime of his health. And didn't his Pete Seeger's father also work for the Smithsonian? That's how he discovered the banjo?
It could be.
You ever hear that story?
I don't know much about it. No, I don't know much about his youth. I just know about his history with the Weavers. I used to play the Weavers here on this time slot, and I was just fascinated with it. And sometime co-host Tuesday on This Can't Be Happening, Dave Lindorf is a big fan and can tell you all about Pete Seeger. You know, he met the guy and knew him, so. Plays banjo locking too, so he's really quite a celebrity in the old left. Which Carl, I don't know if you qualify for that anymore. You're sort of crossed the bridge into Kansas City, new stuff. I mean, new people, new times, same old history. It seems like, but you really seem to have moved in. It's a totally different world out there now, I guess.
No, it is. It took about 10 or 15 years of the internet to really get people linked up and building alternative libraries and that sort of thing. And what I realized in the 90s, by the early 90s, is they were going to need some cooks. And this vegetarian and veganism was a thing that like some of the old hippies that I had got some of their recipes from and started working on. But I still enjoy cooking for a bunch of people. And of course, when you're cooking beans, it's a lot cheaper than shelling out for beef and that sort of thing, But it's a different process, with beans. I mean, you're cooking with a protein, and you need a brown rice combination to make it a long chain amino, so that you can derive some energy from it. And I was reading tonight where someone posted their applesauce cake or something, and then somebody's like, I'm allergic to nuts, and it's like, well, find your own recipes then. Don't complain about my apple cake because it's got a few, pecans in it or something. Well, that's so you get that, where you've announced a get together 6 weeks out, and then the night before, somebody's like, "I have nut allergies. I need a special I have a special diet." One of the things we always did is we'd get a good find a good summer sausage from the deli, You don't have a plate of cheese and summer sausage, you know. So if people needed red meat, you know, then there's your red meat fix right there. And then everything else is like sides, you know, rice and beans.
Yeah.
Another thing I kind of banned was spaghetti because inevitably five people would bring a bowl of spaghetti. And then there was never any room on a buffet table. So then I went with gluten free. So then we were using corn tortillas and things like that. And basically the burrito bowl is the ideal delivery system, you know, for consuming these proteins and carbohydrates that is so needed when you got people traveling all around to get together for a work share weekend. Because once they leave, you might not see them, you know, till next year. So that was the whole idea of really researching. And our friend Kit O'Connell that we had on the show last month just released his soup for our families cookbook was released on Patreon, and he actually took a day off. So I think that went over really well, and I think you can't feed an army on an empty stomach, and it's same way with movement building, you know, it's an important part, just like having your medics, you know, and having your trainers and your speakers, you know, so there's several major components that's required to work together. And for a while we divided it up between the IWW, Incarcerated Worker Organizing Committee, and the General Defense Committee, because sometimes we, you know, if we had Food Not Bombs, they were always, you know, on time. Food Not Bombs was always great to work with here in Kansas City, and so if they were going to cook, you know, we could focus on other stuff, you know, and getting printed materials together. Picking people up at a bus station or an airport, and you know, we used to have Megabus that came through. I don't know if you remember Megabus. They were double decker buses, and you could get to Milwaukee on $36.
No.
So
wow.
Yeah. So right about the time of the Standing Rock uprising, Megabus quit coming this far west. And so that really slowed, you know, that really slowed things down for other activists coming into Kansas City, because then it was by automobile was the only reason to come through here. And of course, I-80, you know, going through Des Moines and Omaha out to Portland, you know, into the East Coast into Virginia, it's They get a lot. You see that with like their entertainment. They get a lot better often bands that don't bother to even, you know, come 5 hours south of I-80. So we've always had to compete with that, and so we were able to adjust, you know, people were, you know, would always, you know, return emails and help you with printed material or updates on printed materials, because that's one thing about the movement building is like every 10 years, every zine, every pamphlet needs to be looked at and updated. And so, you know, you get people that just like to archive stuff and make up backups, because, you know, websites disappear and then all of a sudden the entire catalogs are gone. And, you know, like we, you know, we're talking about Anthony Racing Southside Zine Distro, you know, he's just old school. I mean, he's got like the black jack, visor on, and got his floral printed shirt, you know, from Panama Jack's. There's little nuances that attract people to zines. Now they have a Midwest Zine Con here, and it's pretty impressive, the turnout and how many tables they actually rent out, and so that's always a good thing to see here. But you know, when you start really getting into your radical literature and things like that, sometimes Tulsa or Dallas or Houston or Chicago are the bigger places to that draw. And so, you know, being in the middle of the country, it helps us and hinders us. And one thing I noticed, it's seems to be easier for distros to find cheaper space, you know, or someone that will loan them a place to set up. And Kansas City, it's just really, really hard. Rents have been going up, and the gentrification is just unbelievable. And you know, the road work in town, getting around is tricky, and but you know, and then the COVID, in some ways maybe the COVID is good, and maybe it's kind of pruning back, making everybody like to stand back and think about what they were doing and you know what worked and what didn't work, and you know, using Jitsi and Zoom calls.
I'm seeing that out here in strange ways, and it's strangely enough, it seems to be that the older people I notice are who normally a lot of these old people, no matter their class, seem to be a little bit more polite to others anyhow. But now I notice the middle-aged people are being more, I don't want to use the word civilized towards each other. They're not as quick about jumping in the line in these areas where, you know, it's sparsely populated. So you don't see a lot of people except, like, I don't go out but maybe once or twice a week at the most. I don't leave the house because it's 7-8 miles to the nearest grocery store. Or, you know, anything, post office. It's like 5-6 miles to the nearest post office. So I don't get out. And when I do, I try to make a regular route. And I noticed these changes. At the height of the pandemic, there was nobody out. It was really weird. It was very, very strange. There were literally, I don't know about up there, but it was possible for me to go to the grocery store and be maybe one of only two people in the whole store, and the workers masked up. Now I don't know the experience you had in the city, because I didn't go into the city during that time. But for you, you know, it was I understand a much more intense experience, because there's more people and they've got more things they've got to get done. You know, and people seem to be more polite to each other, at least. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad. Speaking of being polite, I wanted to ask you about this tonight, Carl. What do you think of this? Now, I am of the opinion that property damage is not punishable by death or really extreme imprisonment, anything. However, and I'm not contradicting, I'm just saying I want to let you know my position, but I'm asking you what you think about this news, about these, what they're calling luxury looters I guess in San Francisco and places are having trouble with crowds that are mysteriously appearing and then looting these luxury stores. I mean, do you think we're going to see more of that, or what do you think of that? Is that, what is that a phenomenon, or is it, I mean, what do you think?
I think you know, I was watching a video that was made in Paris about, after 20 years of the war on terror, that people just broke out into the streets, and the relief, the chaos actually bringing a centering force in people, you know, where, you know, it's no longer, you know, the area of the city was no longer recognizable, and you lost your sense of direction, and so I think there's several waves that are compounding this, and I would say the war on terror, you know, so the excessive surveillance, the COVID lockdown, not getting good information about, staying in place and isolating, it's been really, really frustrating. And I've been watching some of this, and there was a hardware store also that was hit this weekend. And I think it might have also been I know in Minneapolis there was one, and I think Oakland there was another one. And so, we were seeing this with the spin out groups, you know, that'll just get over, they'll all show up, and 1,000 people will start hanging out, and people will like burn their tires and just one after one, and just there's such a mob. There's really nothing that can be done about it. And in fact, you know, this Cameron Lamb was racing, the reason why what got him killed. And so you know, we're seeing just extrajudicial punishment just being leashed out just decade after decade now, and you know, so I think a lot of it is just, you know, a pushback to challenge the system that mm-hmm. that is very paranoid and you know, not trusting of the general working class public. So there is more class consciousness going around. You know, whether it's right or not, I mean, you know, or the information, the quality of the information is certainly questionable by some of the comments that I watch on Twitter. I think they develop a scene, sort of a scene mentality, you know, where there might be a couple popular bands, you know, some popular poets, and it kind of circles around that. So I think now that hip hop is being included, you know, it's not uncommon to see, you know, open mic with somebody bringing a laptop and trying out some of the stuff they put together, and then having someone strumming a guitar right afterwards, you know. And there is a feeling that the young people are trying to break the mold. The Louis Vuitton, is like the prized eBay item, you know, the purses.
Yeah. The general public would sell a Louis Vuitton purse on eBay and say, wow, I'm going to make some money off this. But at the same time, it's sort of like a bourgeois accoutrement, you know, it's sort of a something that I don't understand that culture part of it. But That's why I was asking you what you thought of the. Well, that's interesting stuff to think about. So, you've seen some of this, and it's not just a mad looting thing. Not that I consider that a big deal, frankly. But it's mad. It's not just mad looting. Poets' corners. You're saying maybe some musicians and poets and stuff, right?
Yeah, it is. It is a cultural shift. Of course, now you're seeing people being convicted of serious felonies, and their rap albums used against them in court. So, you know, that's one thing I try to explain to the IWW musicians, you know, that your source material, you know, you might want to use something written by the Wobblies 100 years ago. in the event you get called into court, you know, because you're going to have haters.
Yeah.
You're going to inevitably, you know, with the birth of the critic, there's the afterbirth, or with the birth of the artist, the afterbirth, the critic is what Mel Brooks said. And so, you know, what is it? A friend of mine used to say the Jesus had the Nazareth syndrome. You know, you're never popular in your hometown. And
All right. We'll be back in a minute with Carl Keith. There you go.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. For you and me. As I went walking down that ribbon of a highway, I saw the beat of that endless highway. Now I saw below me that
That was Sharon Jones and the Daptones, who play the immortal classic by Woody Guthrie. I probably was a while, but when we get Carl G back in, our host, your host, we'll ask if Woody Guthrie was in the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. But first, we're going to play some more news clips from Carl, something we call the Seattle Hooverville. And we'll be back and have your host, Carl G, back on in about 6 minutes. Hold on here. I got to find the clip.
This one is called Economics and Poverty from the University of Washington under the Civil Rights and History Consortium. Washington experienced the crisis in ways that were somewhat different than other states. The economy had been highly dependent on extractive industries, especially forest products. A government report explained that the economy of the region largely resembles that of a colonial possession. Forest products accounted for most of the state's exports and many of its jobs on the eve of the Depression. This is from the Great Depression in Washington State, Civil Rights and Labor History Consortium at the University of Washington. A tar paper Carthage, interpreting Hooverville. These men who came flooding in from the drenched streets of Seattle as displaced laborers and frustrated immigrants established what was to become the landmark of the Great Depression in Washington. By analyzing the beliefs and prejudice held towards Hooverville by the journalists, students, and film directors who shaped the image of shantytown dwellers in the public mind, I hope to provide more multifaceted examination of the town. It is clear from an analysis of primary sources that Seattle media and entertainment institutions succeeded in alienating the Hooverites through methods of demonization and romanticization, all the while overlooking the triumphs Hooverville embodied for the men who had created it. Hooverville, by no means a luxurious neighborhood, amenities were lacking and sanitation was unheard, and the nearest flushing toilet was located on the beach, across from the precarious and dangerous plank where many a drunken man met injury. 1934 relayed the bizarre and comical story of a donut shipment truck which had been stolen and later recovered near Hooverville with the steady munch-munch of homeless men gorging on the pastries. Showcased the xenophobic uneasiness of the public and the police force toward this multi-ethnic group of homeless men, and three of the nine were sent to the United States Bureau of Immigration to have their citizenship investigated. Lastly, the most significant issue creating uneasiness towards Hooverville was violence and crime. Violence and death were everywhere in the newspapers during the Depression, yet the villains and also the victims of the majority of these stories were homeless, and Hooverville was their hub. Yet these representations, while not demonizing residents, pictured them as flat caricatures of blank templates denying the diversity of homeless men, experiences, and the social complexities of Hooverville life and Depression-era poverty. A movie based on growing shanties of New York City, Man's Castle, was an international hit, frequenting the entertainment pages of the Seattle Times in May of 1936. Starring Spencer Tracy and Loretta Young, this film portrayed love amidst the poverty and crime of shack towns and was an iconic film of the Depression era. The film used celebrity actors to play sympathetic roles, while the film itself relied on universal themes of inequality, poverty, and human resilience. Hooverville was primarily a place for displaced workers to sleep and stay in the wintertime. When jobs were scarce, warmth scarcer, and men constantly cycled in and out of the community. Hooverville had both a mayor and postmaster, and later its own city council. The president of this new council, a 62-year-old homeless man named George Parrish, appeared in a debate over the Beacon Hill shacktown, which was being attacked by the women of the South District Clubs Incorporated. and the Beacon Hill Community Club on November 22, 1938. Harris's words were marked with sincerity and pleading, but also with an honest appraisal of Hooverville's circumstances. "I live in a shack. I try to keep my shack as clean as possible. I don't love living in the place like that, but what I can do when I can get any other place, they tell me. I am too old when I ask for work. I don't want to put a pack on my back and hit the highway. I don't want to live in a boxcar. I'd leave my shack if I could get another place." The final image of Hooverville burning was the last of the romantic portrayals contemporary of the homeless community, and Hooverville depicted as Carthage, the great Phoenician enemy of the Romans. In conclusion, it can be said that Hooverites of Seattle were a highly discriminated and misunderstood minority in the Depression years. The journalists, with their money-making tactic of sensationalism, provided the public with a grim image of their shacktown neighbors, affiliating them with dirtiness, foreignness, sexual depravity, and crime. Meanwhile, the American entertainment industry and scholarly and artistic representations distanced the men of the shacks through romanticized exotic characters. Civil Rights and Labor History Consortium, University of Washington. Seattle's Hooverville, the failure of effective unemployment relief in the 1930s Seattle. Hooverville residents, for their part, were not thwarted by the city's attempt to disband them. They simply dug deeper embankments for their homes and reestablished the community. Jesse Jackson, a more personal portrayal of Hooverville, pointed out the resilient nature of residents. For the most part, they are chin-up individuals traveling through life for the minute steerage. The shantytown consisted of almost all men aged 18 to 60, with little to no income, considering that the majority of Hooverville population was older men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. Many historians have been shocked that there weren't higher death rates. The political structure of Hooverville was based largely around self-declared mayor Jesse Jackson. While the city did demand that the town create a commission of representatives, Jackson was still looked upon as the voice of Hooverville. Jackson claimed that mayor was never a role he sought out, but rather fell into. "You can come here, you can do just what you want. You can't live alone. You have to respect your neighbor, and your neighbor must respect you." Seattle Mayor Dole claimed that he was just upholding the rule of law. However, in a time of economic depression, with hundreds of thousands of Americans struggling to make ends meet, what is the duty of the law? The leaders of Nicholsville urged the members, as well as the members of the community, to encourage government action to fight homelessness.
That's Carl G., your host tonight on the Abolitionist Hour. He'll be right back, and we're getting another part of this intriguing history of the Seattle Hooverville.
Seattle branches of the Unemployed Citizens League by Summer Kelly. They also established cooperative self-help enterprises, declaring that the unemployed would produce some of what they needed on their own. The purpose of the meeting was to call upon authorities to begin development of public works, demanding total expenditure of no less than $1 million in wages. The establishment of a $500,000 wage fund by the county for the same purpose, and another $500,000 for direct relief for needy residents. All work done directly by the city with no interventions by contractors, and work should be rotated fairly among all resident unemployed who register for the purpose. A city scale of no less than $450 per day to be paid for all common labor. No eviction of unemployment for failure to pay taxes, assessments, and back rent. School children to be provided when needed with adequate food by the school board. The purpose of the meeting was to call upon authorities to begin development of public works, demanding a total expenditure of no less than $1 million in wages. The necessity for the central garage of the city of Seattle to repair the trucks, which the local had donated for the specific work of collecting firewood. Firewood collection needed assistance from the county's central garage to repair the trucks, which the local had donated for the specific work. The Unemployed Citizens League refused to turn over the white cards to the county district manager in response to an army of police and motorcycle cops arrived to supervise the moving of properties into the Salmon Bay School, which the county intended to use as a relief station. The Unemployed Citizens League disliked the stifling atmosphere of the public school building where they had been holding meetings. A move to a nearby Lutheran church allowed them to fully air their views. The county had withdrawn trucks for hauling wood, leaving a large amount of cords in the woods while people needed fuel. By October of 1932, the former commissary manager that was implemented by the county faced charges of stealing food from the depot and selling it to a restaurant operator, causing him to be repudiated by the Unemployed Citizens League by a large percentage of the membership. By December 1932, the UCL delivered 24 cords of wood to its own lot with its own trucks using donated gas, which had been the first time they were able to do so in 2 months. Members of the protest then appointed their former relief chairman as the paid commissary manager when that said person joined the league. He was a destitute widower with four small children. Members assisted him in acquiring a house, furniture, and cared for his children while they were sick. The Atlantic Street Camp urged other UCL branches to refuse to send their kids to school in the fall unless the county agreed to appropriate $100,000 for shoes, $100,000 for clothes, due to the fact that 90% of the children of the unemployed were lacking in proper apparel, causing their health to suffer. If the parents participated in the strike, it would emphasize the seriousness of the situation. November 1932, 75 cords of wood needing to be hauled in. However, the county would only allow the use of their trucks if they were given control of the distribution of that firewood. Reported, the paid county managers discriminated against loyal UCL members in the distribution of firewood while county minions got plenty. 41,000 pounds of apples, pears, tomatoes, potatoes, plums, cherries, apricots, grapes, watermelons, and other farm products were brought in, cost to the county in gas at $1.28 per ton. By October 1932, wood operations seriously interfered for lack of oil and truck repairs. The lack of a 50-cent truck bearing, which had been on requisition from the county for 2 weeks, was the issue. Youngstown Camp, February 1932. Pioneered cooperative farming by securing two 10-acre lots and land on the outskirts of the city. The land was obtained rent-free and all produce turned into the local commissary for distribution to needy families. At the Columbia Camp, April 1932, secured 25 acres of land for planting, as well as several houses and apartments for families facing eviction. March 1933, reported success for securing vouchers for a sick woman, delegate given assurance that men unable to work would not be denied resources. At the White Center Camp, February 1932, installed a shoe shop and barber shop with two chairs at the rear of the commissary with two barbers on duty in the day and one in the evening. 60 men assigned to go to the woods every day in two wood crews. 50 women signed up in the auxiliary and made 21 winter quilts. June 1932. Secured a 500-foot site for mill purposes as well as a sawmill. September 1932. Two carloads of police and private detectives arrived with a representative of the county to take over the commissary. A large amount of members voted to withdraw all unemployed workers from the commissary if a paid manager was implemented. In September 1932, commissary workers quit in protest of the implementation of a paid county worker after the commissioner reneged on his promise to remove the man in question.
Well, that is a two-part history on Hooverville in Seattle, Washington during the Great Depression, as read by our host, Carl G. I'm going to see if I can round him up, but first, a classic from Chumbawamba. And this is what you should do with every one of the shows you listen to at the Abolitionist Hour. Pass it along.
In a democracy, ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population has to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
But isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
How about trying this future on for size?
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We do what we want to do, you know. If they consider that selling out, then whatever. Whatever. Whatever.
Who run Napster should be in prison.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
But isn't it stealing?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
Want to download music for free.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do. People are going to do what they want to do.
How about trying this future on for size?
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants. Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We don't mind when our fans pay money to wear our promotional t-shirts. And it's fine when they pay $40 to come to one of our concerts. But when our fans think they can listen to our music for free, they just cross the line.
Wow. Chumbawamba. Let's see if we get Carl back on the air, your host. The switchboards, I'll do all the dirt work tonight, and we'll get Carl on in just a minute. I'll do the dirt work. Hey, it's if you guys have forgotten, it is a call-in show. We've got a couple calls in. You must push one if you want to speak to Carl G or myself. Area code 646-716-8652. And Chris, one, if you want to visit, thank you for calling in. Listening in is wonderful. It's happy. And if you're listening online, you can also call 646-716-8652 if you're on your CPU. Also, this is the Abolitionist Hour on every Saturday evening from 7 to 9 p.m., and here's the address. You want to send them a donation or letters, contact information. Maybe you have a relative that's in a prison. This is for the Kansas City Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, also known as the Kansas City IWOC, I-W-O-C, of the Industrial Workers of the World. You can just abbreviate it. It's K-C-I-W-O-C at Post Office Box. Are you ready? Have you got your pencils out yet? Of course you have. P.O. Box 414304. And again, just address the correspondence, KCIWOC. Go get it to him. P.O. Box 414304, Kansas City, Missouri, 64141. That's Kansas City, Missouri, and the zip code is 64141. And they're on Facebook. Yeah, I've been digging around, and it's linked. All this information is linked in the talk radio at Radio Free Kansas website on the Blog Talk Radio Network page. A little complicated. But you can just go to the Facebook, facebook.com, and it's GKCIWOC. I said Greater Kansas City. So it's GKCIWOC on facebook.com. Do a search and it'll get you right there. Also, the email, you can email them at kansascity@incarceratedworkers.org. So their website is incarceratedworkers.org. And if you want to email them, just put Kansas City on there. Contact us through the website. And now let's see if we got Carl back. I don't know. He may have went out for a cup of coffee or some tea. Carl, are you there? Are you ready? Come back?
Yeah. Yeah, I still got my tea right here. That that Chumbawamba song, that there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I wondered what you'd think of that. I threw that on there to give you a break. Yeah, that's an interesting. It's like your talk about what you were saying earlier about the cultural aspect of these spontaneous assemblies being conducted around the country, and it's not just for looting or riot at its action or burning down buildings. No, that's not even a large part of it. You're telling us a whole new aspect. I think this Chumbawamba sort of got my, I thought maybe I ought to play that for you. And hey, Woody Guthrie, was he a wobbly? Was he an IWW member, or was he sort of like a what? Go ahead.
Communist Party USA is what I understand is. And you know, we have a few wobblies that are diehard Woody fans. You know, and they go out to the Woody Fest in Tulsa, and it's like they don't want to have anything to do with the Little Red Songbook. You know, it interferes with their intellectual purity of all things Woody Guthrie. Yeah. But you know, Woody had a pretty middle class upbringing. I mean, he had all those records of all those blues greats to, you know, and time to study them when he was a very young man, you know, a teenager. And so he was prepped and ready to go. I mean, he had his own show when he got to L.A., as I recall, within 2 weeks of arriving. And had there not been the Dust Bowl, He wouldn't have been forced to leave Texas, so there's and Will Gear, you know, that played Grandpa Walton. Now his wife ran off with one of Woody's friends one time. I know we're kind of going deep in the bound for glory bio, but there's not a more colorful character.
For me, it's the phenomena that Sharon Jones and the Daptones has done a remake of it. I think Bruce Springsteen's done a redux of it. That song, it's sung even in good old conservative, crazy Rivertown, Leroy, Kansas, where I grew up. Well, hell, we sang that since second, third grade in grade school. I mean, hell, that's just, it is like, who would know it was written not only by, I guess, an alleged commie, but more some free-thinking kind of guy that would obviously probably be a friend with the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. I mean, I just see that's sort of funny that you described this sectarianism, but that's okay. I understand. I'm beginning to understand.
It's just funny because I mean, they get prickly about it. They're about their Woody fix, you know. And you know, where I, you know, I mean, I just, I take it, you know, from the, you know, from the angle of, I mean, yeah, he was a genius. I mean, you know, that Huntington Korea, that he, you know, certainly had an effect on his mind and his sense of mortality and everything. And, you know, his ability to just, you know, devour music and interpret it, you know, was, it was amazing. You know, his relationship with Lead Belly. And, you know, who wrote Goodnight Irene for the Weavers, which is still the best-selling single of all time, 1952, Decca Records.
Ah, I didn't know that. Ah.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Yeah. And
well,
so,
I don't have that one. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you just had, you know, it's to me the 1930s was an interesting time, you know, and you know, I was trying to explain this the other day that, you know, by the 60s we were 30 years out of the almost of the Great Depression. You know, there was a generation to look back, you know. And those stories from the Great Depression was like family get-togethers and, oh, yeah, so, you know, it's usually when somebody died in the 60s was, yeah, they were doing this in the 1930s. They survived that, you know. And I have a friend that 14 people died from Spanish influenza. And so there's hardly any memory of any type of oral history from that period. And you know, it's you know, the Steinbeck stories were just, you know, and FDR was a hero up until 1980, and then by then virtually, and now since 1980, just about everything that FDR built has been disassembled by virtually every institution. And so, you know, so we're at this point, you know, where we don't have, we're not 30 years out of the Great Depression. And, you know, World War One, the Great Depression, World War Two, that was like a 30 years war in changing our way of thinking. It had as much to do with changing our way of thinking as just about anything. And we don't know what the young people who've lost their parents, who've lost maybe two or three friends, and, you know, by the third grade, we don't know what effect that's going to have in 10 or 15, 20 years, on the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. So we're like in this you know, it's almost like a wormhole through history. What's on the other side? We really can't vision it until we're actually past the last period. And so, like, the 1990s was really the last of the America that we know, where the Pepsi commercials in sports cars and drop tops, hot rods, uh-huh. You know, the American graffiti, all that. I mean, it's, you know, because in the 90s, I remember old people saying, I went from a horse and buggy to seeing a man on the moon.
Yeah,
and we're quickly approaching, you know, it seems in some ways things are accelerating, because nobody imagined, you know, hundreds of thousands of people would have died. Our mortality rate is off the charts now, and which is really the true history of or the marker of how our rulers led is the mortality rate and whether they had the ability to provide these services to keep the death rate down. You know, I'm seeing like, and there's so many people retiring now, like there's a shortage of snowblade or of truck drivers to push snowplows this winter in Kansas City. How many died?
Yeah,
how many retired? Yeah. You know,
it's in Chicago. That's also a shortage. The city's reporting to have a shortage of it. And boy, that could be serious news in Chicago. It snows like crazy up there. Oh, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's what it is.
Well, no, it's like getting these prisoners acclimated, you know, to a civilian life. I mean, it's so easy for them to get injured, you know. You know, and I try to tell them, you know, when we're on a work detail, you know, is, you know, let's take your time. Let's only do 4 hours a day. We don't have to do 10 hours a day to get this done. And
yeah.
You know, it never fails that, you know, they get a shoulder injury or, you know, I had a problem this week and now the guy's been off for 4 days and, you know, they go in, a lot of times they go in prison as young men, and it doesn't take long for them to become old men in those conditions. So we're in a situation with these shortages.
We are interesting or dangerous or what'd you call it, a wormhole or a time hole?
It's like a wormhole. We're spiraling through time. It's a paradigm shift. And I think we had talked about this before. And so we don't necessarily see where we're headed. Now David Graeber's got a new book on anthropology, and you know, he talks about, you know, like the wisest man that ever lived was a Wyandotte Indian, and that the Enlightenment period came directly out of interviews with him, and you know, in the Huron tribes area, and they traced the Enlightenment period back to this individual. The first time people thought about rights of women and talked about sex and all these things, you know, where before it was just a king, a philosopher king, you know, or Hobbes or somebody.
And
you might have mentioned this, you know, there's so much information that people can access now, and they're learning how to do it. You know,
yeah.
and that all kinds of discoveries are just people playing on laptops are starting to put together, you know, and it's an interesting time, you know. But
yes. Let's back up a little bit. I think you said the guy that's talking about this ancient Native American, I don't know what, creation or myth or whatever. Act is by a guy named David Graeber. I think it is that the guy who spells his last name Graeber. Graeber.
Yes.
David Graeber.
Yes. He was IWW.
I did not know.
His
book. He's dead now, isn't he? I thought he died at a young age.
Yeah, he died of a pancreatic disease last year. This one was finished up, and it was, you know, it was in the final details, and
we might have readers out there. I know our listeners on the weekdays, they're great readers. They read and they tell me about it. Boy, howdy do they tell me about it. Here it is. I think this is the book you're referring to, Carl. It's called The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. David Graeber, Graeber, and David Wingrove, I believe that was pronounced. Is that the book you're talking about with Huron
yes.
and Native American? Wow, interesting. Okay. I just want to make sure people knew where, you know, what the name, they can get that book still. It's out there.
Huh. And I think his name was Quindaranon, something like that. Was, but yeah, so it goes. Yeah, so they try trace the, you know, the Enlightenment beginning. Once interviews of him began getting published by the 1800s, and but just how you know, hunter gatherers, you know how it was believed that they you know, their social structures and things, how they existed. You know, Graeber says, well, no, they would actually break out in, you know, it was seasonal where they'd be like nomadic gatherers, and then as they returned to the city, it was more hierarchical. But also, you know, some of these areas were like the Ukraine and Mesopotamia, in these areas that everybody lived in simple housing. There for 1,000 years there were no kings. And so do you really call a village of 100,000, is that really a city if you don't have a king? I mean, you know, in these complex hierarchies, you know,
yeah,
and so he proves it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah, so they really late.
I agree with you. I'll be quiet. I'll mute my phone. But yeah, I'm going, yeah, I dig it. I dig what you're saying. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Well, no. He's always been an interesting character. David Graeber has always been an interesting character. And the funny thing, when Occupy Wall Street broke out, there was a kid in New York that said, the IWW endorses Occupy Wall Street. And so we're like, we're going on Google, and they're like, what's Occupy Wall Street, you know? And you know, and so it turns out We Are the 99% was David Graeber's idea. And of course, he was fired from Princeton, and as a result of his activism, and so he had to go to London to find work, and the research material for Debt the First 5,000 Years came from UMKC Economics Department. And so that's another interesting, you know, and. You know, where he talks a lot about barter, you know, and how you know, anthropology and archaeology and you know, mixed. And they said the genius of that was he made it like a Shakespearean novel. You know, he made it in story form rather than you know, some type of economic analysis of how it took place. And you know, so you know, trading calves for wives or for children to marry and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Things that we can relate to here in the Midwest still.
Yeah.
But
oh yes, out here, a stump broke cow is still a name claim. Go ahead. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Old Stumpy. I remember tales of Old Stumpy.
Well, hey, wait. We got 19 minutes in. There's a guy, a musician who I think is an IWW musician. It's Leon Russellson or Rosselson. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I got two of them here on the line, but I'm going to play one at least tonight. I'm going to play one at least here. Well, this is a little song called Upside Down, a version of by Leon Russellson, allegedly of the Industrial Workers of the World. I don't know. Well, we'll see.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common, and to make the waste grounds grow, this earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor folks starve. We work, we eat together, we need no source. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the Lord. Still we are free, though we are poor. You dig us all, stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
Leon Russellson with The World Turned Upside Down. And we are rejoined Carl G. and a caller. Hold on, wait for the beep. Here we go.
Welcome to the Abolitionist Hour. You're talking to Carl and Mike.
Hey there, Carl.
How are you?
Nice to meet you. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, my name is Hotep, H-O-T-E-P. And I was scrolling through Blog Talk and I saw your interesting themes. And it just seems as though our prison system is structured to snag mainly financially poor people who may have either made the wrong decision or may be innocent, but either way, it's a system that really, I think, needs total revamping so that we have a more fair and just, prison system and legal system. And by the way, I was just doing some research about Margaret Sanger. She was a eugenicist and racist and the founder of Planned Parenthood, and the New York chapter, which is the largest, I think, in the world, took her name off the building and finally admitted that Margaret Sanger was a racist, a eugenicist, et cetera. So if that happened, maybe we can also all bring down the prison system, energy and using the right tactics. I appreciate the chance to say these things. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Yes, as Pete Seeger said, we're all digging with spoons, but, we have to keep digging. And I appreciate your insight. And we have a history of eugenics in this part of the country. There was a sociologist from Merrimack Community College outside of St. Louis that did the research where the housing projects were being sprayed with metal cadmium.
Wow.
And one of the sprayers were off the Knights of Columbus building there in St. Louis. And as we dig into this history, this is also the area where they were taking the enriched uranium and processing it for the bomb that ended up being made in Kansas City. And St. Louis being the Dresden, the chemical city of North America, the station wagons would come through spraying with mosquitoes, for instance. And we just joked about it, that we're being experimented on, it was just sort of, we just took it for granted, but I've lived in some of the most toxic real estate on the planet, when you get hit, with these substances, because it's basically like coming down with a flu, yet nobody else has the flu. And especially my experience in the Army where you're lining up and you're getting 50 inoculations at a time, people are trying to argue with the drill sergeant, and the sergeant saying, look, when you sign the dotted line, you agreed to be experimented on.
Wow. Yeah, a friend of mine that was in the military told me that experience, and that the guy next to him dropped dead because they had said, don't take two shots, but he got things confused. On the second shot, he went down, and that was it.
Yeah. So the things we write off as the progress of men, the history's out there, and there's a chance eventually it'll all be dug up, but it's opening people's eyes, and as Leonard Cohen would say, everybody knows what time it is.
Well, what happens is when the history is finally dug up, the evil people that would have accomplished their goal, meaning, people would have died in the scenario, or they would have taken some land in the scenario, and then they just come up with some new tactic or strategy to accomplish the task later. It's rare that the International Criminal Court holds them accountable. The ICC holds third world leaders accountable, but not developed world leaders. And you don't see them kicking their doors in and taking them to jail and locking them up. It's like robbing a bank. If you rob a bank and take $1 million and then somebody figures it out 20 years later or 30 years later, you rob another bank, and we're being dragged continually toward more fascism and hate and war. And it doesn't seem as though the liberal progressive side has the funding and the balls of the fascists, who are willing to drive cars into people and choke people, shoot people, poison people. By the way, speaking of poisoning, I've done some research in New York. In New York, they built a complex for black people on a toxic dump. It's called the Riverton. They also built a school in Spanish Harlem, but the water was tainted and kids were getting sick for a long time. And then there's a park called Riverbank State Park. Well, the park is in the black and Latino community, but they built a sewage facility in the middle of the park. So people started getting sick, and some still are getting sick. In other words, all the stuff goes up. The land itself is tainted, where the people sit to send vegetables. Well, right below them is a sewage plant. It's so much, not to mention what happened to the Native Indians. And, of course, the Irish and free blacks were in Central Park, but they kicked them out and built – well, not were in Central Park. It wasn't a park at that point. And they kicked them out to build Central Park. And that's just a tip of the iceberg for New York. If we look at what happened across the country, it's just a tragedy. And hopefully the government one day will, apologize and pay reparations and bring us all together and end all the division.
Well, You know, I'd read where Nixon knew that salaries were dropping, but one thing he could give to the white working class was white identity. And that seemed to have pacified them for a couple generations, but that has run out, you know, and you know, so we're hoping to see a stronger anti-fascist movement in the future, and the Charlottesville verdict this week, we've yet to see what the real blow will be to, you know, because they can mutate into a new fascist organization, which we're already seeing. Now there was one that committed a fascist that committed suicide two nights ago. Yeah, and maybe we need to play Chumbawamba the day the Nazi died.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Which guy was he that killed himself?
Let me see if I can. I can look him up. He was with Proud Boys. He was with Autumn Waffen.
Oh yeah. I saw that in the news. You're right. Yeah. I think he was.
Okay, so,
wasn't he the black leader of Proud Boys or the?
Oh no, no. Tario is out of Miami. Now he's in prison. He's in federal prison.
Okay.
This guy went by several names. Luca Lunderman. Luca Nazi Scum is what he's referred to, and I think he was about 26 years old. But he was, you know, he was a content creator, so he was doing editorials and things for the major Nazi websites.
Wow.
And so we don't know exactly. We've not found a manifesto, but this is antifascistchicago.noblogs. Mm-hmm. You could find that if you want to look. And Unicorn Riot has their file on him of all the of course he was not Unite the Right, but all the groups that he was involved in street demonstrations around the country. And so yeah, Blake Luca Linderman.
Sorry, I confused my news stories. I was thinking of the guy that went to jail. But yeah. By the way, with Nixon also created a Southern strategy to divide Latinos from blacks because they were a strong voting bloc. And so in that strategy, they divided them and created in one of the national research projects where the Latinos could call themselves white. But the problem is that we're all one family. So if they can keep dividing us, what happens is we don't get to do a French style, oh, it's the ones on the top. We blame each other. Oh, no, it's the Irish. No, it's the black people. No, it's the Latinos. And everyone keeps fighting. Meanwhile, on the top, you know, we're being exploited. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah, we made it to the you've heard of the 1619 Project. We made it out to Hamilton, Virginia, and that summer, and that the first 19 slaves arrived there,
mm-hmm.
and basically the Europeans were only interested in mining for gold and getting back to Europe. So it was very hard. It was very hard for them to establish a colony early on, and slavery seemed to be seemed to be the issue. You know, there was conflicts between the Dutch and the British, and so you couldn't, you know, a British citizen couldn't be doing business with the Dutch, and it's a really interesting history of some of those descendants are still there, and you know, some of them work for NASA, and Eleanor Roosevelt, the first suburban community was designed through Eleanor Roosevelt, and they're at Hamilton, and they have they built a school in the 1920s. It's just you'd think it was 10 years old, and so that was really so that would be Suffolk, Virginia, and then the mm-hmm. naval base being about 20 miles to the north. But yeah, that was that's an interesting. We try to hit a little bit of the underground railway, and so this was the Dismal Swamp was the starting point where the Jamaican Maroons actually came, you know, after the revolution in Jamaica, actually came and you know, the involvement with Harriet Tubman and teaching people how to, it's literally a path. The Underground Railroad was, this Dismal Swamp was like 1,200 square miles, and so you can still see parts of it where they actually filled the path in, you know, so it was submerged, or so it was no longer submerged, and the Dismal Swamp was eventually drained, but you know, there was a lot of timber out of there, and so it was just interesting, you know, when you see, you know, if you're a history nerd and you get to some of these places, and you can see where these, you know, it was built by hand, and you know, they were weaving baskets and carrying dirt in, you know, on their backs, and you know, mile by mile completing this, and so we have a leg of the Underground Railroad out here in Kansas, and so it made the UNESCO preservation site. So the prisons are just, it's absolute treachery. They're set up in these rural areas where there are no jobs, and some of them are just vicious. I mean, there was a book that was written called The Belly of the Beast about 30-40 years ago, and he said the Ozark rednecks were the meanest prison guards in the United States. And so when we started doing research into prisons in our area, you know, somebody told us, you know, that you're going to find an Angola. Every state has an Angola prison. And of course, Angola, Louisiana being, you know, were the slaves that came from Angola. And then when they were no longer slaves, they became prisoners in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, go ahead. If you got anything else you want to say, I appreciate you calling in. It's a very interesting guest.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it's my first time calling, but I just want to close by saying that we're all really family, because what happened was we came from a land called Africa. Some of us went into Caucasus Mountains. Some went into Asia. You know, different phenotypical traits changed depending on climate and diet, and here we are now with all the division, and the ones, like I said, that benefit are the ones on top that pull the strings. The rest of us need to come together and start thinking more logically, rationally, and intelligently, because global warming should be our focus. We shouldn't be worried about, you know, who's the guy, who's the girl, who's dark, who's light. We should try and save the planet. Thank you so much for the time.